But who's caring for the rights and needs of migrants working as living caregivers? Migrante Ontario is a non-profit organization advocating for the rights and well-being of migrants working as living caregivers. The passing of Bill C-50 has made it easier for people working in Canadian migrant worker programs to work with temporary status, but harder to gain permanent residency. Working with temporary status in Canada leaves the rights of migrant workers far less protected. However, most migrants who come to Canada are led to believe that they have the chance to become Canadian citizens. Interested in getting involved with the Guelph contingent of Migrante Ontario? Connect with us at migrante.ontario@gmail.com. That's migrante.ontario@gmail.com.
The following is brought to you by Echo Weekly.
Weed. Weed is a touchy word, but for the people who publish Echo Weekly, we recognize that this is an issue of debate. What does marijuana represent? Does it represent something that's going to harm society by making us fall away from our basic responsibilities? Or is it just a way to have fun?
Echo Weekly, free every Thursday.
Welcome to Terra Informa, weekly environmental news all across Canada. I'm your host of this week, Sana. This week, Miles interviews with Rissel Turton from COP16, 16th session of Conference of the Parties, and Rekka talks with David Schindler about the effects of oil sand development. Delegates from around the world are currently gathering in Cancun, Mexico for the latest round of UN climate talks to discuss global efforts to address climate change. It's not just government officials converging in Cancun. However, many individuals, environmental groups, and indigenous people are packing the city to have their voices heard and to hold delegates accountable to the grassroots demand for climate justice. Next in Terra Informa, Miles Curry talks with Rissel Turton about traveling to Cancun on a climate caravan.
Rissel Turton traveled this past week to the Cancun Climate Talks by way of an international caravan. These caravans are organized by international and Mexican activists and are designed to bring local struggles against social and environmental injustices into the limelight as the global community convenes for the climate negotiations in Cancun. For a first-hand account of these caravans, I contacted Rissel in Cancun. Can you give me a brief overview of your trip from Canada to where you're at in Cancun?
I joined up with the caravan in a little place called El Salto. It's pretty close to Guadalajara, and it's in the state of Jalisco. That was one starting point of three different starting points for the caravan, and then there were three different caravans that converged on Mexico City. In El Salto, it was really interesting hearing about their experience there, and it was, you know, jumping right into everything, and they've been experiencing very extreme contamination of their water. If you go down and look at it, you can just see the foam shooting up from the water, and you can tell that obviously something is incredibly wrong there. They have photos as well as a waterfall, and you can actually see foam all the way up to the top of this essentially waterfall there. And so visibly it's quite startling, and then hearing the stories as well is also quite impactful. They've been seeing a lot of cancers and other illnesses in their community, which they attribute, and it seems quite sensible, to all the contamination in that river. And going down and seeing the river, speaking with a 12-year-old boy there who has lost both his parents, he lost his father to cancer, you can just very much see the impact in the community.
Wow, I mean, that's amazing. You went on this caravan, and how many stops would you be making like this along your path?
Quite a lot. We started on the 28th. And it's the fourth now. We just got in last night. And so there were a number of stops along the way. We are typically making at least one stop a day. And then there were different people joining up with the caravan that have different problems going on in their community. And actually, even after the caravans converged, we sort of split again because there was just so much there. And our schedule was jam-packed. It was really quite exhausting. Which I suppose is disturbing in a lot of ways when you think about all the devastation out there that's affecting people so much. It's definitely been a huge lesson in environmental justice for me, really seeing it firsthand. You know, I've heard it before about how places like Canada, the industrialized world, were sort of exporting a lot of the costs of our environmental consequences elsewhere, and that's where the devastation occurs. But to actually see it up close and personal is quite different. And the connections to Canada are quite astounding as on the caravan coming from San Luis Potosí. It was a Canadian mining company that had caused a lot of the devastation in the area. There's a mountain there called Cerro San Pedro, and it's basically gone now, and it's going to be left as just a crater in the ground. And they've been using this cyanide extraction technique, which is even banned in parts of Europe now, but is going ahead in Mexico, and the consequences seem to be quite extreme. They use a massive amount of water for this project. They've basically torn apart the mountain, and the people in the community had said they basically went into the river, and the river is running quite dry now from what I hear. And the mine is so bad that the community has been organizing against this. They even took it to court, and in court they did find it to be illegal. It was in violation of the regulations, but nonetheless the mine has been continuing because the Mexican government allows it to happen, the Canadian government allows it to happen.
That's unreal. With this happening every single day, you're going to see these consequences. What's the daily life like on the caravan? Like, how do you deal with this, and how do you interact with the other travelers on the caravan?
Well, to be honest, it is incredibly overwhelming. You can think of any situation. Traveling to another country in itself can be pretty overwhelming. Then there's the difficulty with the language barrier. I speak some Spanish, but have an awful lot to learn, so that's been challenging for sure. And so it's difficult when there's so much going on, so much to take in, and there's that sort of difficulty around understanding all that's going on around you and that communication barrier between you and a lot of the local people. But I can't complain. It's been a very good experience on the caravan, and there's, you know, it's an international solidarity caravan. There's a number of international people that are down here, and it's really good, sort of the support and the connection that's come through all of that.
Interesting. Where do you see the caravans leading to into the climate change negotiations? Do they have any momentum going forward? Are the people sort of building towards any other actions?
Well, the caravans have led directly into this forum, the Forum on Life and Environmental and Social Justice. Both the caravans and this forum are organized by Via Campesina, which is an international movement of peasant farmers. So there's definitely that momentum. And there is reaction to it. People think this is really good that international folks are coming in, seeing the local struggles. And for me, it has really helped to put things in perspective, too. When thinking of sort of climate justice, environmental justice, it's really made me think of climate justice as just like another piece very much fitting into the environmental justice scene. I can see very much all the nasty impacts of the industrial development products we're consuming in Canada and the environmental footprint of that, and how devastating that can be for local communities here. And climate justice then just seems like a really, really nasty addition to that, where the huge cost of climate change is being borne by countries outside of Canada first, and the poorest countries typically, who don't have the same sort of capacity to respond to it, and who don't have the same responsibility for this crisis either.
What are the local people in these places you visited sort of saying? Like, what do they see as the solutions? What do they hope that you can do? Do they ask you anything as you're traveling through?
I've actually been really surprised with the local organizers and how much they're speaking to the links between everything and talking the need for systemic change. I guess that's one of the huge messages coming through for me. On that first stop in El Salto, they did an action there, and they had these signs up that said, "Cambiemos la sistema, no el clima." Let's change the system, not the climate. And so that's been interesting to see how they're very much making these these links. Like, this is part of the same system that has been exploiting and abusing our people for quite a long time. It's exploiting and abusing the natural world, and we need a change of the system. It can't be small changes. This is a big problem. We can't just make little tweaks. We've got to fundamentally reconsider our economic system.
Wow, Russell. I mean, this is really powerful to hear these stories, and I really appreciate you sharing them. Do you have a website or any place that people can go to follow the rest of your trip?
Yeah, I'm getting updates onto www.pialberta.org, and if you just go to the environment section there, you'll be able to find Alberta to Mexico for Climate Justice is sort of the heading there.
Awesome. Thank you very much for joining us on Terra Informa, Russell, and I hope you have a great journey, and we hope to catch up with you again soon.
Thank you very much, Miles.
Okay, bye.
Ciao.
For more info on Russell's trip, Canadian activists, and delegations in Cancun, check out our website, terrainforma.ca, and listen in next week for more updates on the climate conference directly from Cancun.
Thanks, Miles. If you have questions or comments about anything you hear on Terra Informa, look us up on Facebook or send us an email at terra@cjsr.com. Next up, here's Marcus with this week's EcoBubble.
Diversity.
Automated metering infrastructure.
Natural energies.
Regulate CO2.
PM control strategies.
Natural resource exploitation.
Steady state.
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Uranium.
The Enhanced Oil Recovery.
Sustainable Energy.
EcoBabble.
Hey guys, here's your EcoBabble for this week. Emissions. Emissions is an umbrella term that encompasses any waste discharged into the air. This could be from a smokestack or your car's tailpipe. Of course, we hear a lot about carbon emissions, the discharge of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere responsible for the majority of the human-induced greenhouse gas effect. Other important pollution emissions include sulfur oxides, responsible for acid rain, and nitrous oxides, the main constituent of smog. Carbon monoxide is another airborne pollutant. It is a colorless, odorless, non-irritating, but very poisonous gas that replaces the oxygen in your blood if inhaled at low concentrations. Volatile organic compounds, known as VOCs, include the potent greenhouse gas methane, as well as other chemicals like benzene and toluene, which are linked to leukemia. Ammonia is emitted from agricultural processes, and much of it comes down with rain to land in the oceans, where it can cause toxic algae blooms. All of these chemicals are released into the atmosphere in gas form, but there is another whole class of airborne pollutants known as fine particulate matter. It consists of tiny particles of liquid or solid suspended in the air. When the tiny particles and the air that they're suspended in are taken together, it is called an aerosol, a term you're probably familiar with from numerous household products like deodorant and hairspray. Human activities have drastically increased the amount of aerosols in the atmosphere, and they are linked with numerous health problems, including heart disease, lung disease, and even cancer. So, if you've ever heard the term emissions and wondered what that meant, well, now you know.
Thanks, Marcus. If you're just tuning in, this is Terra Informa, a weekly environmental news program. From our website, terrainforma.ca, you can find all additional information that you want. Dr. David Schiller is the Killam Memorial Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. An internationally renowned aquatic ecologist, his current research focuses on fisheries management in mountain lakes, the biomagnification of organic clearance in food chains, the effects of climate change and UV radiation in lakes, and global carbon and nitrogen budgets. With his most recent research, Dr. Schindler has stirred up quite a controversy in Alberta. He and his collaborators have published 3 papers in extremely prestigious scientific journals that address the question of whether oil sands extraction and upgrading in the region north of Fort McMurray, Alberta, is releasing toxic metals and organic pollutants into the Athabasca River. The results contradict what he calls the propaganda put forward by the Alberta government, who have long claimed that any measurable toxins in the Athabasca are simply the product of natural seeps, and that the oil sands mining and upgrading activities do not contribute to the river's contaminant load. The province has based this conclusion on monitoring carried out by the Regional Aquatics Monitoring Program, better known as RAMP. Dr. Schindler presented a summary of his results to the University of Alberta's Biological Sciences Department and offered his explanation for why his results differ so significantly from those of RAMP. Terra Informa correspondent Rebecca Rooney recorded his presentation and brings us two-part special. Today we have part one of measuring the effects of oil sands development on Athabasca River ecosystem.
Those of you who read newspapers probably realize that I've got an ongoing rumble with the Alberta government right now. So what I thought I would do today is to show you why our results don't agree with those of the Alberta government scientists. So this is the sort of propaganda that our current government is putting out these days. Nothing is happening in the oil sands. Every pollutant in the river is natural and so on. And their monitoring shows that industrial contribution can't be detected against historically consistent readings. Well, first thing, I reviewed their database in 1996 as a sabbatical project and found that the data they had were only for a few ions and things, and even they didn't meet very basic chemical standards like cation-anion balance. So they don't have long-term data, and in fact, if you look for the organic pollutants, they have a couple of years for 11 or 12 stations. So their position is that little seeps are the source of all of the pollutants in the region. Well, I've been designing watershed studies since 1966. And in 1981, I chaired a U.S. National Academy panel to look at the output of fossil fuels and burning and its impact on the biosphere. They had two reports done in the 1970s showing large amounts of particulates being emitted at that time. That was, of course, when we had two sleepy little tar sands plants. In my mind, having a coke-burning stack that would be not putting out every toxic element that's in what it's burning, which is, in this case, coke manufactured on site from the oil sands, would be akin to immaculate conception, something like that. So to that degree, we knew that we were going to find something. And there were a few clues, thanks to the Sierra Club and EcoJustice. As of 2007, they had to start making public what they were releasing to the air via Environment Canada's National Pollutant Release Inventory. So if you want to check up on your favorite company and see how they're doing, just Google NPRI. This huge database pops up with every toxin known to man and every company in Canada. So note here, the beginning about 2005, which is when the plants approved in the round of 2003 hearings started to produce, the output of some of these pollutants started to skyrocket, probably all. I've picked three that I think are of concern in that region. Note, this is hundreds of kilograms of lead. You do the numbers on that, and you're clearly going to be able to pick that up as deposition with even the crudest methods. And arsenic, much the same thing, a little slower increase, but still, they're all up about threefold. A lot of the data that they bring up, when you challenge them on those statements that I read, they say, oh, see this paper or that paper or that paper. You look at the papers, some of them are 2001, some are 2007. Without exception, they're written around data taken 2001 or earlier. So they don't reflect this big period of expansion. The one time that the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program was reviewed in late 2004, it's about 100 pages of scathing criticism. They didn't do anything visibly with that. You can't even get it on the RAMP website because it was blurry. They're in the process of a second review now, and that review is supposed to be released this month sometime. So we'll see if they've improved any. I would bet almost
not. So that's the kind of database that they're challenging our papers in PNAS and Nature with. So by coincidence, in late 2007, an opportunity presented itself. After the Lake Wabamun spill, three of us were summoned by Alberta Environment and DFO, who didn't think they had the capacity to evaluate the Wabamun spill. So there I met Jeff Short, a scientist with the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who had worked for 20 years around the Exxon Valdez and had some really much more sensitive methods than anything we'd seen here, and Peter Hodson, who I had met before but never worked with, who's a toxicologist with a lot of oil sands experience. And we hired Erin Kelly, who'd done her PhD with me in the late 90s, and we started out by plotting this white area, which is the McMurray Formation, where all of this surface bitumen, or near surface, is contained, and then setting up a very detailed sampling where we sampled several sites upstream of development on the Athabasca and downstream all the way to Fort Chipewyan. And on every developed tributary, we sampled outside the McMurray Formation, upstream within the McMurray Formation, but upstream of industry, and then at the mouth, where below industrial development. So we designed our sampling not to monitor the river, but to test this hypothesis that it's all natural. That river is covered with ice for 4 to 4.5 months of the year. Makes a kind of an interesting a reference situation because the airborne don't get in during that time, and very little in the way of surface runoff. So what gets into the streams then has to be via seepage and via groundwater. So I'm going to go through our snow results first. The simplest way to measure atmospheric deposition is to use snow. We sampled snow after it had lay on the ground for 4 months, so we assumed that by multiplying that by 3, we would come up with a reasonable estimate of annual deposition. We melted the snow down and filtered it. When the filtrate was looked at, looked nice and clear at unimpacted sites when you're over 50 kilometers away from a tar sands plant. Near the plants, there was actually visible oil on top of the snow. We plotted the data. Type 1 deposition was a straight exponential fall away from the two upgrader stacks, which are across the river from each other, right at our site, AR6. So you can see you can detect contamination out to about 50 kilometers. So that straight exponential drop was what we called type 1. Type 2, you can see, has a little bit of a bump here. And type 3, considerable material outside of 50 kilometers. So we classified them by that type of distribution. They have challenged and said, how do you know that isn't all just blowing dust? Well, the reason we know it's not blowing dust is that if you calculate the amount of bitumen in the snow, it's 3 times richer than any dust in the area, even from the highest grade of bitumen in the oil sands. So they probably ought to be mining snow rather than oil sands. And all of the fractions for the polycyclic aromatics, the organic pollutants, were type 1 distributions, as you can see here. This is mercury in parts per trillion. The provincial people will tell you, oh, it just keeps increasing as you go downstream. It's total nonsense. The reason they think that is that they don't have enough sites, or any sites in some cases, in this industrial area. So you can see this clear spike right where industry is. And there's arsenic, much the same pattern. There's lead, much the same pattern. And polycyclic aromatics, the same thing. And it falls away, again, as you go downstream. Tributary is the same thing. And here we can do both summer and winter. And again, the pattern is pretty clear for most, but not all metals. I see beryllium there. There's very little difference, for example. And if you look at the mainstream Athabasca, again, you can see the highest concentrations are in the developed area. And they actually tail off below that. Again, for most of the elements of concern, like mercury and arsenic and cadmium. Some of them, like beryllium, it's not the case, but can't say that you really care about beryllium, not a very highly toxic substance. So there's a number of reasons why our data don't agree with theirs. They don't have enough sites to distinguish natural from industrial sources. They keep talking about their 30-year data set, but for these organics, they have less than 2 years. They're only sampling at the mouths of tributaries, so on the tributaries they can't separate natural from industrial. The Athabasca River is sampled upstream of industry, but their next sample downstream is right in the heart of the industrial activity. How can you say that you're assessing the natural separately from the industrial? For these polycyclic aromatics and mercuries, RAMPS detection limits weren't good enough. Their published ones are 20 to 200 nanograms per liter. Ours for the same congeners are 0.001 to 0.6. Mercury, theirs are pretty good. Ours are better, but there have been two studies that have shown you don't expect to see an increase in dissolved mercury with an increase in input. Where you see the increase is in the biota. It's very quickly methylated and moved up the food chain. There's two papers, both published in 2007, from experimental studies done by adding isotopes, in one case to mesocosms, in the other case three different isotopes to three parts of the watershed. They both showed that if you increase the mercury load, the methylmercury in fish goes up within a couple of years. So they like to say, well, the fish have been high in mercury since the 1970s. Well, maybe that's the case, but with the sort of airborne load they're getting, I'm sure they're higher now. A lot of the papers that they keep holding out to us, if you look at when the data were collected, they're 2001 or earlier. They don't reflect this 2005 expansion at all. And probably the most definite thing, they've never measured these things in precipitation. And I think they'll find out when these panels get to it that anyone who knows the literature on atmospheric deposition is going to tell them if they assume that that's negligible, they're smoking something. So we are sure that there are major industry-related inputs and elements. There is natural background, too. My guess is that the industrial input has at least doubled the amount in the river. We really think a better managed monitoring and research program is needed, and that material needs to be put out in peer-reviewed journals. Some public reporting, not propaganda, but what's really going on in the river. If the public decides, yes, we're going to continue to develop the oil sands when they've seen the data and show what a mess it is, that's fine. I guess that's democracy at work, and I can agree with it or not. But to put out this absolute crap, propaganda, probably paid for by the taxpayer to a large degree, to bamboozle taxpayers and to think that nothing is going on. It's not democracy at work.
Thanks, Rebecca. These are whole issues of this week. Thanks for listening, and I hope you meet next time again and again. And also, I want to say thank you to Steve for producing this gorgeous news and Miles for updating our website every week. We Terra Informa are looking for volunteers and enthusiastic listeners all across Canada. If you want to join in, just drop us a line at 780-492-2577, extension 236, or send us an email at terra@cjsr.com. I've been your host, Sona, and hope you make great weeks.